Hi, Susan. Hello, everybody. I hope you guys
Hi,
can hear
Virginia.
me.
Yes, we can hear you.
Recording in progress.
Okay, Chair Tatayan, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you. Welcome, everyone, to the November 18, 2021 Delta Stewardship Council meeting. I'm Susan Tatayan, Chair of the Council, and I am very glad to be able to be with all of you this morning. Let's start with the roll call to establish a quorum, starting with, the judge is not here. Maria Maranian.
Maranian's here.
Virginia Madueño.
Madueño here.
Don Natoli.
Yes, Don Natoli here. Good morning.
Christy Smith.
Smith here.
Daniel Zingali.
Zingali here.
And Susan Tatayan here. We have a quorum. A little bit of housekeeping. If any member of the public is interested in providing public comment, please send an email blue card to the clerk at engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov, as seen on the screen. Almost. There it is. Be sure to note your name and the agenda item that you wish to comment on. Also, please note if you wish to speak or would like the clerk to read your comment for you. When your name is called, the clerk will unmute you or read your comment if requested. So on to agenda item 3, the consent calendar. Council members, this is an action item. Let's first find out, are there any public comments on item 3?
There are not.
Thank you, Beck. Members, is there any need for any discussion on the items on the consent calendar?
I'll move to adopt.
Second.
Okay. Motion to adopt the consent calendar by Council Member Daniel Zingali, second by Council Member Maranian. Let's start with the vote. Excuse me, a little disoriented this morning with some household issues. Are there any objections to adopting the consent calendar?
No.
Okay, then in that case, hearing none, the motion is adopted, and we'll move on to agenda item 4. Agenda item 4, the chair's report. This morning, I want to report that I participated in the November 16 kickoff meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Group for Phase 2 of the Delta ADAPTS initiative. And as you know, Phase 2 is to develop a climate adaptation strategy for the Delta region. And during the meeting, our team did a very good job of getting some very good initial input. And the team emphasized that this is the first meeting and beginning of the conversation, and that there will be many more opportunities for providing information and suggestions to the council as it develops the adaptation strategy. So I think the breakout sessions at this first 2-hour meeting were a productive beginning to receiving valuable input for framing development of the adaptation strategy. I also attended the November 17 initial meeting of the Environmental Justice Expert Group that will be providing advice and input to council staff who are to write a white paper on environmental justice issues affecting Delta communities and resources. And so our staff at this meeting did an excellent job. And on this topic, our staff is already receiving good advice and suggestions from this group for refining the information gathering strategy for the white paper. So these two meetings were recorded, and I recommend viewing or listening to the recordings when you get a chance. In each of these meetings, I was inspired by the level of interaction between the meeting participants and the council staff. And we are very fortunate to have staff who are very good communicators and listeners. So council members, I'd like to offer an opportunity if you'd like to share any updates at this time. Okay, well, seeing none, let's move on to agenda item 5, the public comment on any council-related topic not on the council's agenda for today.
There are no comments, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Beck. Well, in that case, let's move on to agenda item 6, the executive officer's report with Jessica Pearson.
Good morning, members, and thank you, Chair Tatayan. First up, an announcement. As identified in the Council's 2021 priorities, or what we also refer to as our work plan, staff have been working on a proposal to revise the Council's appeals procedures for covered actions. The Council's appeals procedures were originally developed before the adoption of the Delta Plan and years before any covered actions were submitted to the Council, as well as any appeals. The proposed revisions are designed to address lessons learned while processing the appeals that we have received over the past 3 years and are intended to improve the process for all parties. Staff anticipates releasing a draft version of the proposed amendments on our website on or around December 10th for a 60-day public comment period in advance of a council workshop, which we'll schedule for our January meeting. I do have one covered action certification to report on since we last met. On October 28th, the Central Valley Flood Protection Board submitted a certification of consistency for the American River Watershed Common Features Sacramento East Levee Contract 3 project. The board finds that the proposed project is consistent with 8 Delta Plan policies, while the remaining policies are not applicable. The project seeks to construct levee improvements to meet embankment and foundation stability requirements along the American River as part of the larger American River Common Features Project that I've reported on in the past. The project's public review period will close on November 29th, and information is available on our website on our covered actions page. I have one outgoing comment letter to report on this month. We submitted a letter to the Department of Water Resources on November 1st regarding their proposed mitigated negative declaration for the Georgiana Slough Migratory Barrier Project. The project seeks to reduce the diversion of juvenile salmon from the Sacramento River into the interior and South Delta. The letter outlines applicable Delta Plan policies regarding invasive species and local land use and invites DWR to meet with the council in early consultation. Other updates to projects we are tracking are always included in the monthly active projects report. And if you'll indulge me, I have quite a few personnel announcements this morning. We have 3 new staff to welcome and 3 promotions to celebrate. First, please join me in welcoming Pat Kelly as a new senior environmental planner in the regulatory review unit, where she will support covered actions review, consultation, and our appeals processes. Before joining the council, Pat was with the CPUC, the Public Utilities Commission, in their energy division, working as a project manager in their CEQA unit. Pat has been working for the state of California for approximately 10 years and has over 20 years experience as a land use planner for PG&E. Pat has extensive experience with CEQA and land use, building, and grading permit approval processes, which will come in very handy for our work. We also welcome Kim Voniak as a staff services manager specialist. She is a retired annuitant working for the council in our HR office. She joins us with over 10 years of HR experience, including most recently with the California Department of Food and Ag. And I'm really excited to announce that a new executive fellow from the Capital Fellows Program, of which I am an alum, has been placed with the council. Chris Clyer is from Rancho Santa Margarita, and he obtained his Master's of Science degree in Environmental Sciences and Management from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. As a climate change adaptation graduate researcher at Cal Poly, his thesis explored a survey of climate adaptation rates, barriers, and opportunities on 200 vineyards in the Paso Robles region. He's also worked as a watershed intern and with the San Luis Obispo Climate Coalition. Here at the council, Chris will be working closely with Amanda Bowl and will support Delta Plan Implementation Committee initiatives over the next year. The Capital Fellows Program is a nationally recognized public policy fellowship that offers unique experiences in California policymaking at the executive, legislative, or judicial level. And I'm really proud that the council can take part and host our fifth executive fellow since 2011. And now I'll quickly mention three promotions at the council. Corey Copeland has been promoted to senior environmental scientist within our performance management unit. Corey's been with the council since 2017, serving as a subject matter expert in performance measures for water supply reliability, risk reduction, and Delta is Place. In his new role, Corey will lead implementation, tracking, and reporting of performance measures on human dimensions, flood risk, and climate change issues, and in particular, in support of our environmental justice issue paper and our Delta Adapts work. Julia Schmitz has been reported to staff services analyst in our HR office. She also just had a baby last week. Yay. Julia has been with the council since 2020 in our business services unit, where she assisted with the council's response to the pandemic and transition to telework. And she helped facilitate our office move as we've transitioned to our P Street building. Lastly, Andy Wong, who you've all worked with, I'm sure, in IT setup or troubleshooting, has been promoted to IT specialist. He's been an integral part of that team since 2016. We always appreciate Andy's easygoing demeanor and his willingness to work with us on these complicated IT problems, and he always does so with a smile. It's greatly appreciated. So please join me in welcoming our new team members and in congratulating Corey, Julia, and Andy on their promotions. Next, let's look ahead at today's agenda. So first, the council is going to conduct a workshop, and this is on our draft program environmental impact report for the ecosystem amendment to the Delta Plan. This document was released in late September. The workshop is an opportunity for the council to receive an overview of the draft document and for the public to provide comments directly to the council. The workshop will begin at 10 a.m. Next, representatives from the Delta Conservancy, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and a Delta landowner will provide background for the council on the emergence of carbon capture and storage project planning and conversations that are happening in and about the Delta related to those projects. That concludes my executive officer's report. I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Any questions for Jessica, council members? Okay, well, hearing none, thank you very much, Jessica. On to agenda item 7, the lead scientist report with Dr. Laurel Larson.
Thank you, Chair Tatayan, and good morning, council members. One of the biggest happenings in the Delta Science program this month is that we are, after much anticipation, finally releasing the draft 2022 to 2026 science action agenda for public comment, and we're on track to do so today. This culminates over a year of hard work by many in the science program, particularly the Collaborative Science and Peer Review Unit headed by Henry DeBay. Rachel Klopfenstein was the lead on the Science Action Agenda effort, so she deserves a big congratulations. Kudos are also due to everyone in the executive team and in the Delta Science program who reviewed and provided comments on the document, as well as the communications division who helped prepare it for public release. So as you've heard from me before, the Science Action Agenda is a document for and by the Delta Science community that prioritizes science actions for funding and attention at the 4 to 5 year timeframe. The 2017 to 2021 Science Action Agenda resulted in $37 million in funding by several agencies, including the Delta Science Program. This past summer, you heard our report on the exciting projects being funded through the 2021 PSN, all of which are directly responsive to the Science Action Agenda. Today, we'll be coming full circle because I will be profiling findings that have emerged from a project that we funded in our 2018 PSN. That funding was awarded to the Brander Lab at Oregon State University, which works on the impacts of contaminants on ecosystems. So Brandon, if I could get the slide now, that would be great. In 2021, two papers were published by that lab in the journal Toxics on their work in the Delta, one by Segarra et al. And the other by Hutton et al. Collectively, these papers address Science Action 4D of that 2017 to 2021 Science Action Agenda, which is to evaluate the effects of toxicity on aquatic species survival, including possible effects on predation. And this was an action that saw significant progress according to our 2021 progress summary. So the paper by Segarra et al. Looked specifically at how exposure to one of two common agricultural pesticides at concentrations typically found in the Delta impact the behavior of larvae of the endangered Delta smelt. The larval stage was of interest here because the Delta smelt spawn between late fall and early spring when rains wash higher amounts of runoff containing these pesticides into the Delta. The study also looked at how interactions between these pesticides and salinity impacted the behavior of smelt larvae, which is an important question given that sea level rise and drought both tend to elevate salinities throughout the Bay Delta. Salinity can effectively change ionic bonding properties at a molecular level, which could impact the way or rate at which contaminants are taken up into cells and their overall toxicity for the organism. After exposing different test groups of captive Delta smelt larvae to their assigned levels of pesticide concentration and salinity, the researchers quantified their overall swimming activity levels and also where they were swimming in their containers. Healthy Delta smelt larvae will hug the walls of their containers, which is an instinctual behavior that indicates an evolved strategy for avoiding predators in the wild. So as you can see from the photographs on the lower right part of this figure, this wall-hugging behavior was lost when larvae were exposed to any concentration of this particular agricultural pesticide by fenthrin. The researchers also found that higher salinity levels further decreased this wall-hugging behavior, which suggests that the interaction of salinity and pesticide exposure in the wild put the Delta smelt at increasing risk of predation. So the other main finding that came from that paper was that all levels of pesticide exposure also changed the larvae's activity levels compared to the control group. And in some cases, the smelt larvae were more active, and in other cases, they were less active. So in the second study, the one by Hutton et al., the question of the extent to which agricultural pesticides increased the mortality of larvae at two different salinity levels was addressed. So the difference between the first experiment that I profiled and this one is that in this experiment, the researchers were looking at a greater range of pesticides. So they were looking at seven different pesticides. And they were also examining effects on mortality or the concentration at which the larvae will die. The other difference here is that the researchers conducted their experiments on inland silverside instead of Delta smelt. Inland silverside is found in many ecosystems, including the Delta, and it's commonly used as a model organism by the EPA in studies of contaminant toxicity. So as with the first study that I profiled, this study also showed that higher salinity enhances the toxicity of agricultural pesticides by up to about 50% for some concentrations of triadimethon, and I might be mispronouncing the names of these pesticides, but this was the pesticide whose toxicity was found to be most enhanced by salinity. So the bottom line here is really twofold. First, agricultural pesticides have behavioral and survival impacts on key fish species in the Delta at all concentrations in which they're typically found in the Delta. And then second, rising salinity levels during drought or as a result of sea level rise serves as a double whammy by enhancing the toxicity of those contaminants. Studies such as this one are critically important as a conceptual basis for assembling models that forecast the future suitability of the Delta for species of concern, And also, they're necessary for providing scientific underpinning for contaminant management strategies by entities such as the EPA and regional water quality control boards. So I'm going to pause there and ask if there are any questions on these two articles that I've spotlighted before moving on to the next part of my report today. And I will scroll through the participant list to see if I see any hands. I almost called you Congressman, Councilmember Natoli.
Thanks, Angela.
What a promotion.
Thank you, Dr. Larson. I just was curious, the pesticides that were the ones used in this examination, what are they commonly used, or what crops are they commonly used on? Any idea? And where they emanate from? Are they from upriver? Are they adjacent to farming operations? I'm just curious as to.
Excellent questions. Yeah. And I can find out the answers for you. I don't know them off the top of my head, but I do know that they're typically used as insecticides or fungicides. The guess that I would hazard is that they are used both in Delta and also upstream, but I could look for some more clarity for you on that.
Okay, that would be helpful. I guess just the other thing, are they most typically associated with farming operations, or are they household use as well? So they could be run off from lawns, from commercial and industrial applications. Again, I'm just curious as to, again, kind of go back to my first question about, maybe where the source is, but where it may emanate from as well.
So. Yeah. In the second paper that I profiled, which is actually the one shown in A on this figure, there were seven different pesticides looked at, and some of those pesticides are commonly used in a residential setting, but others are commonly used in agriculture. I believe that the study B that you're looking at here primarily dealt with agricultural pesticides, okay. But I'll verify that for you.
Okay. Again, thanks once again. I mean, you help make science very understandable, certainly, and I get highlighted the work that folks have done in their research, and the graphics, I think, help, in a more simple fashion to make it understandable. But even the in that lower right hand corner there, where you just show the concentrations in the swim paths, that was, it's very
neat. Those are neat. Those are figures. So the two figures on the right come directly out of the two papers. So kudos are really due to the authors for assembling those figures. And I will acknowledge Karen Gutierrez here, our Sea Grant State Policy Fellow, who always is the person who creates the visual, the slides that you're looking at during my report. So great. She does an excellent job with those.
Yes, so very illustrative. So thank you very much. I appreciated the information. And I'll,
you're welcome.
Look forward to the clarifications. Thanks.
Thanks for your questions. Any other questions? Okay, if not, I will go ahead and move on to my update on Delta Science Program activities. I decided to make the big announcement about the upcoming release of the Science Action Agenda for public comment at the outset of this report, and also because I think it's important to make the point that not only do we fund this work, but a key role of the science program is to report back on the work that we fund. The only thing I'll add in this update on the Science Action Agenda is that public comments on the document will be due on January 21st. So there are a couple of months to get those in. And this Science Action Agenda will officially be presented to the council at its December meeting. I'll also call your attention to an extended report out on the State of the Estuary Summit that took place on October 1st. That is in your packet. I did briefly summarize that in my last lead scientist report, so I won't do so orally today. Now, I know that several of you have been tuning in to the four-part Environmental Justice Brown Bag series. The third talk, which took place on November 3rd, pretty recently, featured Dr. Kyle White from the University of Michigan. He discussed tribal management of natural resources, tribal disenfranchisement, and how tribal groups are organizing around those topics and are really central to the environmental justice movement. He spoke of how all communities should be involved in natural resource management and how tribal communities deserve sovereignty. His work inspires thought around how the Delta Stewardship Council and other natural resource management agencies can learn from tribal communities that have long-term experience around natural resource management and how they could better incorporate those communities' values. I encourage you to visit the recorded talk, which can be found on the council's YouTube channel. And then I also want to encourage you to tune into the next talk, which will take place on Wednesday, December 8th at noon. And in that seminar, Dr. Raul Lievanos of the University of Oregon will speak on climate justice related to sea level rise and flooding risk in Stockton. So very much with a focus on the Delta. The Delta Lead Scientist Ask Me Anything series is also ongoing. On November 1st, I co-hosted a session with two-time California Sea Grant Delta Science Fellow, Denise Colombano, to discuss the Delta Science Fellowship. She was formerly awarded a fellowship for her PhD at UC Davis, and now she's a second-time Delta Science Fellow working on a postdoctoral research at the University of California, Berkeley. This fellowship is our mechanism of funding early career scholars to advance research that addresses science actions outlined in that science action agenda, and also to help them connect their work to the management community. Former Delta Science Fellows have gone on to become some of the top leaders in our science community, and also those of other locations. In the new year, the Delta Science Program will announce a solicitation for the new class of Delta Science Fellows. And again, these fellowships are available to postgraduate students at the master's level through the postdoctoral scholars level. So stay tuned for more news on that in the new year. But do, if you would like to spread the word about this or just point people to a source of information about this fellowship, do point them to the council's Instagram Live archive from those sessions. So the last program activity that I'll report out on is the Delta Interagency Invasive Species Coordination Team's Biennial Symposium on Delta Invasive Species. That is scheduled to take place on December 15th in a fully virtual format. The topic of the symposium is early detection and rapid response to species invasions. It will highlight current, and I'm just going to use the acronym EDRR for early detection and rapid response, because that's a mouthful. So it will highlight current EDRR efforts, lessons learned, and future challenges and opportunities for that EDRR work. The symposium will also provide an opportunity for participants to contribute feedback on the draft Delta EDRR framework, which is being developed by that Delta Interagency Invasive Species Coordination Team. Registration for the symposium is now open, and you could find details about how to sign up for it in your packet. And then finally, for the By the Numbers report, you may have seen that with the precipitation statistics, this water year is so far one of the wetter ones on record. The Northern Sierra's precipitation statistics are at 270% of the average to mid-November, and the Central Sierra is at 187% of the average to mid-November. However, as I mentioned last month, this doesn't mean that we're out of the woods for drought. Reservoir storage is still at about just half of what is typical this time of year, ranging from 45% in Shasta and the San Luis Reservoir to 58% at Oroville. The Sacramento River is currently running at 88% of its historical average at Freeport, while the San Joaquin River at Vernalis is at just 48% of its historical average. So we're still anticipating what this current water year is going to bring, whether it's going to end up continuing to be a wet year or a dry year. There's a lot of uncertainty around that, but we still need to be preparing for water shortage conditions, most likely, as this water year moves on. So with that, I will conclude this report and open the floor to any questions or eventually to public comment. Council Member Natoli.
Yeah, thank you again, Dr. Larson. I just was curious on the on your by the numbers on the water temperature. It's, you know, in one case, 3 degrees higher. We had all the precipitation that you just referenced. And I'm curious, is it because the reservoirs are low? Is it because there was a significant amount of runoff? Is there any connectivity to the recent storm events, or is it more because of the drought that we're running?
I would say it's more because of the drought that water temperatures are warm. Cold water pools and reservoirs do tend to get depleted during drought, and it's just more difficult in general to manage temperatures. The other thing is that there have been some recent studies that have shown that there is a correlation between delta inflows and temperatures, where when you get higher inflows, temperatures tend to be lower. So if we're still restricting inflows to the delta as a result of the drought, which is the case, then temperatures are likely to be warmer.
So if I could just deduct from what you just said, so that we're holding more water in the reservoirs because they were depleted, versus if we had a more normal year where your releases might be increased a bit, that could be a contributing factor.
So a combination of that and the depletion of cold water pools within the reservoir. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Good. You're welcome. Any other questions? Well, thank you all for giving me the chance to present to you again.
Thank you, Laurel. And I too wanna chime in on the congratulations for the Science Action Agenda completion, that excellent work by the staff and just really admire Rachel Klopfenstein's tenacity. It's quite an endeavor.
She was truly amazing in getting this document together in the time frame, and all of the coordination that it took with members of the Delta Science community was an incredible effort, and she pulled it off with aplomb.
Yes, I agree. Are there any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
Okay, thank you, Beck. Well, in that case, council members, we have notified folks that the workshop on the draft programmatic environmental impact report for our proposed amendment to Chapter 4 of the Delta Plan, Agenda Item 8, will take place at 10 o'clock. So that's a definite start time on that. So since it is only 9:35, we'll take a break and I'll see you back here at 10 o'clock sharp. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, Chair Tatayan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Bob. Well, thank you for your patience, everyone. We will now move on to Agenda Item 8, the workshop on the draft program environmental impact report for the proposed amendment of Chapter 4 of the Delta Plan, Protect, Restore, and Enhance the Delta Ecosystem. Just to let folks know, this workshop is being recorded by a reporter to ensure a complete and accurate notation of all comments. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per person, and commenters will be called in the order their requests are received. So Jessica Pearson will be introducing the item. Jessica?
Thank you, Chair. By way of background, the Council elected to amend its Delta Plan Ecosystem Chapter soon after the Brown administration in 2015 decided to move away from the then proposed Bay Delta Conservation Plan. Can you hear me?
Now we can.
Now we can.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Let me start again. Sorry. Okay. So by way of background, the council elected to amend its Delta Plan ecosystem chapter soon after the Brown administration in 2015 decided to move away from the then proposed Bay Delta Conservation Plan. The Bay Delta Conservation Plan had included, in part, a comprehensive ecosystem plan for the Delta. The original Delta Plan Chapter 4, adopted in 2013, or the Ecosystem Restoration Chapter, as we call Chapter 4, was therefore developed with an expectation that the Bay Delta Conservation Plan would eventually be incorporated into the Delta Plan. That was what the legislature envisioned. When it became clear that that no longer would happen, the council decided to move ahead with this amendment to make sure that California would have a blueprint for large-scale ecosystem improvement and restoration in the Delta. The council has been advising staff and reviewing iterative drafts of the ecosystem amendment since 2017 and authorized staff to begin the CEQA process in May 2020. On September 27th, the council released a draft program environmental impact report for public review. And today, as part of the public process, we're excited to hold a workshop to discuss the draft public environmental impact report or programmatic environmental impact report. So today's workshop will include an overview from our staff of the document and an opportunity for the public to provide oral comments on the draft. In addition, anyone interested in commenting on the draft can provide written comments during the public comment period, which runs through November 30th, and they can do so by emailing ecosystemamendment@deltacouncil.ca.gov. After the public comment period closes, staff anticipates reviewing and responding to comments and developing and presenting the final PEIR in mid-2022. With that, I'd like to introduce Jeff Henderson, Deputy Executive Officer for Planning and Performance, to walk us through the workshop.
All right. Thank you, Jessica. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And could we please have the PowerPoint presentation? So thank you, Jessica. It's my pleasure on behalf of the staff who prepared the ecosystem amendment to guide us through today's workshop. And as you mentioned, we'll begin with the background of the amendment itself, walk through some of the key components of the environmental impact report that's been prepared, and then we'll have an opportunity for some dialogue and public comment. Next slide, please. So again, this provides the background for our presentation today, and as relates to the CEQA process or the California Environmental Quality Act process, we'll talk about the organization of the environmental impact report, the alternatives that we considered, which is one of the requirements for the council under CEQA, and key conclusions of the program environmental impact report. And then we'll provide next steps as we continue to proceed through the update process. Next slide, please. And just again, by way of background for purposes of the workshop, the Delta Plan includes a chapter related to ecosystem restoration. And the Delta Plan itself is the Comprehensive Resource Management Plan for the Delta and the Marsh that was called for in the Delta Reform Act. The original plan was adopted by the council in 2013. And the key parts of the Delta Plan, or kind of the active parts of the Delta Plan, are regulations that are applicable to what are known as covered actions, which are certain discretionary actions that occur within the Delta led by state or local public agencies that meet certain criteria established in the Reform Act. Those projects must address the regulations or comply with the regulations that are spelled out in the Delta Plan as policies. There are also recommendations within the Delta Plan to other agencies to take steps to help to implement the Delta Plan's objectives and the co-equal goals. And the plan includes performance measures to help us track progress over time. And all three of these components, proposed policies that would eventually become regulations, recommendations to other agencies, and performance measures to track progress. All three of those parts are components of the proposed amendment. And since 2013, parts of the Delta Plan have been revised due to a variety of different change circumstances and conditions in the Delta, including the shift from the Bay Delta Conservation Plan that Jessica mentioned in her overview, which is the impetus for the ecosystem amendment. Next slide, please. So chapter 4 of the Delta Plan is the ecosystem chapter, and it was originally developed based, as Jessica mentioned, on the expectation that the Bay Delta Conservation Plan would be incorporated into the Delta Plan. And in 2015, agencies that were acting on the Bay Delta Conservation Plan shifted their approach from that plan to a more focused set of mitigation projects. And to address that shift in planning and implementation, the council began developing an approach to update Chapter 4 of the Delta Plan in 2016. The council also, through this process, determined that the ecosystem amendment was a project under the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, and that a program environmental impact report, or program EIR, was the appropriate document to prepare in order to analyze and propose mitigation for the potential impacts associated with other entities implementing the Delta Plan amendment. And we'll talk a little more about the structure, content, and assumptions of the EIR towards the end of the presentation today. Next slide, please. The ecosystem amendment reflects an important shift toward ecosystem-based management, with particular focus on getting larger, more connected restoration projects in the right locations on the landscape as quickly as possible. The proposed amendment does not involve construction or operation of any specific facilities or other specific physical actions that would be taken by the council. Rather, it provides guidance and a vision for restoration. At a high level, it could help projects that contribute to multi-benefits in terms of flood, multiple benefits in terms of flood risk reduction, continued agricultural productivity, additional habitat benefits as well. It can help projects that contribute to ecosystem function by restoring the food web, even if much of the land remains in agricultural production in the future. It can help projects that contribute to resiliency, to shocks and ability to adapt to climate change for the ecosystem and for flood risk. And an important component of the vision does address funding and institutional coordination, which requires political will based on solid science to fund and implement projects in the future. And we would be guiding those projects through the regulations that are proposed as part of the amendment. One opportunity that does exist is to stack various different funding sources, again, such as through multi-benefit projects. Next slide. So the need for the ecosystem amendment was really driven by the pivot from the BDCP, changes to the environment, new science, and some understanding based on lessons learned from restoration projects regarding what has or has not worked. The proposed amendment takes a more comprehensive approach and a more ecosystem-based approach to achieve the goals and strategies that were defined in the Delta Reform Act. It's based on 5 core strategies, which are listed here on the slide, and we will walk through each of them in turn. These core strategies form the basis for what then is carried forward as 6 policies and 15 recommendations that address protecting, restoring, and enhancing the Delta ecosystem. Only one policy that we're proposing is entirely new, and it's focused on transparency and reporting, which will help us track implementation of projects over time. Next slide, please. So the first core strategy one, is focused on using best available science to manage flows that support the needs of native species throughout their life cycle. It seeks to create more natural functional flows by requiring covered actions to be consistent with the State Water Resources Control Board's Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan flow objectives, and that there's no change to that particular policy. This core strategy also seeks to work with the State Water Resources Control Board to ensure best available science informs its regulatory decisions regarding stream flows and water quality. Core strategy one includes one existing regulatory policy and proposed revisions to one recommendation addressing the points that I just outlined. Next slide, please. Core strategy two complements the first core strategy as more natural flows are the most effective when they're flowing across a restored landscape. Core strategy two identifies five priority attributes for projects to restore ecosystem function. Those priority attributes are to restore hydrological, geomorphic, and biological processes, to be large scale, to improve connectivity, to increase native vegetation cover, and to benefit at-risk natural communities or species. This core strategy also discusses the importance of designing restoration projects with consideration for their surrounding land use context. So taken together, these attributes and compatibility with surrounding uses are important considerations with regard to prioritizing restoration projects on the landscape. Next slide. So core strategy two seeks to restore ecosystem function by requiring covered actions to consider and disclose how they would improve ecosystem function and provide social benefits using those criteria that we just summarized on the previous slide, and by requiring consideration of expanded floodplains and creation of riparian habitat in levee projects. Core strategy two also seeks to recommend increased public funding, good neighbor strategies that coordinate restoration with adjacent uses, and exemptions for delta levees from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers policy that otherwise prohibits vegetation on levees. Next slide. Core strategy three is focused on addressing the challenges posed by land subsidence and sea level rise. This strategy is organized around two objectives. First, it seeks to protect the existing but limited opportunities that exist for tidal marsh restoration. And the graphic that's shown here is from the narrative, and it shows types of conservation activities that would be appropriate at different elevations within the delta. Tidal marsh restoration is shown in the intertidal restoration band as an illustration of the concept of having the right project in the right place on the landscape. The strategy is also focused on halting and reversing subsidence with consideration for sea level rise, and three new recommendations are proposed to support this objective. Next slide, please. So core strategy three seeks to protect land for restoration and safeguard against land loss by requiring habitats to be restored at appropriate elevations for current and future conditions, and by protecting land with the best habitat restoration opportunities from incompatible uses. Core strategy three also seeks to recommend enhanced working landscapes, developing or updating management plans for public lands to halt or reverse land subsidence, and recommending funding to reverse land subsidence. Next slide, please. As we know, non-native invasive species harm native species in the Delta in a variety of ways. Core strategy four is focused on enhancing and enhancement and management actions that would support native species and reduce the impacts of non-native species. It seeks to protect native species and reduce those impacts by requiring covered actions to avoid introducing or expanding habitat supporting non-native invasive species. This is what we refer to as policy ERP5, and there's no change proposed to that policy within the amendment. But core strategy four also recommends actions to control non-native invasive species, including predatory fish, improving fish migration within the delta and the upper watersheds, funding projects that help juvenile salmon avoid predation and being trapped by water intakes in the South Delta, managing hatcheries to reduce genetic risk and improve the resilience of native species, and coordinating remote fish tracking programs. Next slide, please. And the fifth and final core strategy seeks to improve institutional coordination to support implementation of the amendment by recommending support for the implementation of ecosystem restoration programs and projects, and by aligning state restoration plans and conservation strategies with the Delta Plan. This core strategy identifies the existing Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee, or DPIC, as a forum for federal and state agencies that have some responsibility for restoration in the Delta to help coordinate funding, land ownership and management, permitting, and science support. Next slide, please. So the council released a preliminary draft of the ecosystem amendment for public review and comment in 2019, following this period of 2016 to 18, where we set the foundation approach and prepared science synthesis papers to help support the development of the policies and recommendations. Based on public comments received, council staff further revised the November 2019 preliminary draft, resulting in a May 2020 draft. That May 2020 draft incorporates extensive feedback from the council, from Delta stakeholders, from the Delta Independent Science Board, from independent scientific peer reviewers, and from the public. And that May 2020 draft then forms the basis for the project description for our draft program environmental impact report, which was issued in September 27th of 2021. Next slide, please. So this slide outlines our CEQA process. We're now kind of moving from the amendment into the CEQA process. In 2020, in May, we released a notice of preparation and a draft version of Chapter 4, as was mentioned on the previous slide, initiating a 60-day response to comment period. We did receive numerous responses to that notice of preparation that are outlined and addressed in the draft program environmental impact report. Our draft program environmental impact report was released on September 27th of 2021, and we're now in the midst of a comment period that originated on that date and will end on November 30th. Once we receive the written public comments, we will be preparing a response to comments and revisions to the program environmental impact report that will be contained in a final environmental impact report that will be issued in spring of 2022. And if the council ultimately approves of the ecosystem amendment and certifies that final environmental impact report, we would initiate a rulemaking process for the new and revised proposed regulations at that time in 2022. Next slide. So I wanted to just take a moment and review a range of the types of comments that we received on the notice of preparation for this environmental impact report. We got comments regarding the description of the proposed project to be evaluated, a number of concerns or suggestions regarding the core strategies and sort of the components of the project itself. We got comments regarding the range of alternatives that we would be evaluating in the environmental impact report. That is one of our requirements under CEQA, is to consider a reasonable range of alternatives to the project. We received comments regarding the definition of environmental and regulatory settings throughout the document, technical and resource-specific considerations across the different environmental impact areas, suggestions regarding projects to be included in the cumulative impacts analysis, and comments regarding consistency of the document with and compliance with existing laws and plans, including specifically the public trust doctrine. And the staff has proposed a number of non-substantive changes to the proposed amendment to address a number of these comments. And they're also addressed throughout the program environmental impact report. Next slide, please. So the environmental impact report addresses what we're referring to as the primary planning area, which is shown in purple on the map on the screen, which consists of the Delta and the Sassoon Marsh, as well as the extended planning area, which is shown in green and beige and comprised of the Delta watershed and areas outside the watershed that use Delta water. Now, this is important because for each impact assessment in the document, the program EIR analyzes effects within both the primary planning area and the extended planning area with greater detail and precision within the primary area. This is the same approach as was taken for the 2013 Delta Plan and the 2018 Delta Plan amendments and the environmental documents prepared for those efforts. Next slide, please. So a bit of background on program EIRs. These are types of EIRs that are allowed under CEQA to evaluate plans or programs that are comprised of multiple actions or components. The actions or components must be related geographically by applying rules or regulations or as logical parts of a long-term plan. These are different than what are typically known as project EIRs in that individual projects are not analyzed. A program EIR can be thought of as an advanced planning document. It provides disclosure about potential impacts to the environment. It can inform the public and decision makers about potential impacts. It identifies ways to avoid or reduce potential impacts, improves public awareness and transparency, and provides a high-level assessment of policy decisions prior to the consideration of individual projects. This particular program EIR assesses the potential effects of different types of projects and activities that could be undertaken by other entities in response to the proposed ecosystem amendment. Next slide, please. So the PEIR, or program EIR, evaluates the potential impacts of various types of projects that the proposed amendment in the Delta Plan would encourage and promote throughout the primary and extended planning areas. And this ultimately is because the council is not in the position of implementing the ecosystem amendment through sponsoring individual projects. The types of projects that would be coming forth following the ecosystem amendment would be implemented largely by other actors, other entities that are driving these projects. The EIR considers the types of general activities, the types of potential projects, and various construction methods that could result from implementing the ecosystem amendment. Again, it doesn't involve construction or operation of facilities. Our regulatory policies apply to covered actions of the state or local agencies. And for example, this would include the following types of general activities. Within the primary planning area, improved function and connectivity of floodplain habitats, restoring, protecting, or enhancing wetlands, streams, riparian habitats, and upslope watershed sites, subsidence reversal activities, and potentially removal of non-native terrestrial and aquatic invasive species, and revegetation of sites with native plants. That would be within that primary planning area for the Delta and Sassoon Marsh. Within the larger watershed planning area, the types of projects include potential fish passage improvement projects, hatchery management projects, and it is important to note that some projects in the primary planning area could also affect the extended planning area, for example, through projects that would potentially change flows. Next slide. So CEQA defines a range of topics that must be addressed in an EIR, and this program EIR addresses all of them. The impacts and mitigation measures are summarized in the executive summary to the EIR, which is table ES4, and the details associated with the potential impacts and proposed mitigation measures across all of these topics are identified in chapter 5 of the program environmental impact report, with a separate section for each topic listed. And those sections comprise existing settings, so the existing environmental setting, the existing regulatory setting, potential impacts, and proposed mitigation measures. And again, the proposed ecosystem amendment does not involve construction or operation of specific facilities or other specific physical actions by the council. Next slide. So for purposes of a conservative analysis and recognizing that the council is not the prime actor with regard to implementing the program environment or implementing the ecosystem amendment, the EIR concludes that there are significant and unavoidable impacts identified for all but two impact areas. And again, this is a conservative approach that recognizes uncertainty, that recognizes that the actions to be implemented would be by entities other than the council, and that ultimately these significant unavoidable impacts will require a statement of overriding consideration when the council certifies its final program environmental impact report. and those less than significant impacts, the two issue areas with less than significant impacts are energy resources and population and housing. Next slide. EIR also typically proposes mitigation measures that are means to reduce the potential impacts associated with a proposed project and then kind of steps that projects can take or components that can be implemented to help reduce those. Many of the mitigation measures that are in the ecosystem amendment remain unchanged from those that were part of the 2013 Delta Plan. Although there was an effort made to clarify language, remove some duplicative coverage, reflect updated formatting and current standards where we could. For non-covered actions implemented in response to the ecosystem amendment, these mitigation measures are recommended as opposed to required. It's important to note that the Delta Plan's policy GP1B2 requires covered actions to incorporate either the mitigation measures that are proposed or adopted as part of the Delta Plan EIR, or equivalent mitigation that is equally or more effective. And that's a component that enters our covered actions review process through policy GP1B2. New mitigation measures have been added to this particular effort for designing projects to minimize agricultural land zoning impacts, minimizing loss of special status plant species, and several sub-measures are related to avoidance or minimization of impacts to special status species. We've also included a new measure related to siting and impacts for recreational facilities. The mitigation measures have also been updated to reference newer best practices, particularly in areas such as emissions reduction, air pollution emissions reductions or greenhouse gas emissions reductions, buffer marking on construction sites, and aesthetic and visual resource best practices. Next slide, please. So the environmental impact report also addresses a range of alternatives to the proposed project, which is again a requirement of CEQA. And we analyzed the proposed project as well as four alternatives. The no project alternative, which consists of existing conditions at the time of the notice of preparation, and what we would reasonably expect to occur without the ecosystem amendment. And then three alternatives, 1, 2, and 3, one being protecting maximizing protection of agricultural land by reducing the impact of ecosystem restoration projects on agricultural working lands in the Delta. A second alternative, reduced waterside restoration, which would not promote channel widening and levee setback projects. And a third alternative to reduce the overall restoration footprint by reducing the target restoration acreage as expressed in the performance measures that are proposed as part of the project. So all three of these alternatives are means to adjust the proposed policies, recommendations, or performance measures in manners that would reduce the potential impacts associated with the project. And it should be noted, alternative 3 is identified as the environmentally superior alternative, again, a function of CEQA and a requirement to identify which of the project alternatives most reduces those impacts and could be potentially environmentally superior to the project. Next slide, please. Similar impacts were found between the proposed project and the no project alternative, but the no project alternative does not meet the objectives of the proposed project or the objectives of the ecosystem amendment. The three project alternatives all have similar impacts, but impacts are reduced in some resource areas. And again, alternative 3 is identified as the environmentally superior project under CEQA, but it only partially achieves project objectives. And so it enables, the council is enabled to adopt or move forward with the proposed project in light of this finding through a statement of overriding considerations. And so we'll get to that when we're addressing the final EIR in the spring. Next slide, please. So again, a review of our next steps. The draft PEIR was released in September. The public comment period runs through November the 30th. The nature of the comments on the draft program environmental impact report are not yet known. If there are requirements to significantly change the approach, this would be a burden to the council, and the current approach assumes a response to comments and that revisions would be complete and a final EIR issued in February or March of 2022. And at that point, again, if the council approves the proposed amendment and certifies the final environmental impact report, we would initiate the rulemaking process. Next slide, please. So that concludes the presentation, and happy to entertain any council member questions, and we look very much forward to public comment.
I have a question.
Yes, Maria.
This is Maria. My question is that we developed the three alternatives, and the three alternatives, two questions. One is, are there subject to still adjustments and modifications at the time that we start the work, number one? And number two, are they subject to approval by any other entity?
The alternatives.
Mm-hmm. The three alternatives.
The three alternatives are essentially proposed in the EIR to help describe the difference in impacts between the project and those alternatives that are mm-hmm. proposed. Mm-hmm. They are not necessarily actionable alternatives in the sense that the council would proceed with the proposed project informed by the steps that could be taken within the alternatives. But ultimately, we're pursuing the project objectives mm-hmm. for the work.
So the alternatives were, so when we implement the project, these alternatives are the ones that were not picked.
Correct.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Okay.
Yeah, but that is a-
Could any entity say, you know, I'm trying to see the process of the CEQA process and all that, could they be brought back in at any point for discussion by any other entity or even modification of our proposed or chosen alternative?
The council could certainly consider components of the alternatives as part of the proposed project.
But not the other stakeholders.
Well, other stakeholders can and likely will provide comments on those alternatives that the council can take under consideration with regard to its action on the proposed project.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Jeff?
Sure.
Don.
Yeah, just briefly, maybe piggybacking on Maria's question, Jeff. So you said that the alternatives would inform the project, but once there's a certification to the environmental document, then the project has been defined, the, you know, as you've outlined, the various implementation aspects have been incorporated into the chapter for the ecosystem restoration. So I guess I'm curious, when you say inform, so you would carry over elements into the project and that would be incorporated, or you have proposed project as you've outlined. So how do these alternatives, I guess, in the backdrop, either as we go forward to consider this and move it forward to the spring, but also I guess after that, I mean, are they set aside?
Right. I'll offer a preliminary response, but I might also ask Kathy McAfee, who's joining us today, to help with some of those responses as well. But the alternatives are proposed in the EIR to help compare what the council's proposing in the proposed project with different steps that the council could take within the project that would reduce impacts. Those steps, to varying degrees, do reduce those impacts, but are less effective relative to the project's original objectives than the proposed project. So in terms of what the alternatives help to inform, they help to inform ultimately the council's decision regarding the proposed project in light of the potential reductions of impacts in the other alternatives. But it's not necessarily a pulling of a component of the alternative and placement of the project. It's more the council looked at a range of different alternatives when it chose to approve the proposed project, when it chooses to approve the proposed project, and considered those relative impacts and those reductions, and ultimately within findings that the council would prepare at the time of final action, ultimately determined that the benefits of the proposed project outweigh the reductions afforded by the alternatives.
Jeff, just let me ask you on that point then. So for example, you could use any one of the alternatives here, but the first one was the ag land protection, obviously reduced water side restoration and restoration footprint, reduced restoration footprint. So I'll just pick the first one. So if ultimately the project is approved, then the alternative that was offered in alt one, the ag land protection, we're choosing the project over that alternative. But what about then, again, coming back to the point when you said that the informing about how, you know, the working landscape for agriculture is impacted by restoration and or elements are incorporated so that, you know, fish-friendly farming, you know, wildlife-friendly farming, a lot of different, you know, acronyms, I guess, that folks use, but for descriptions. So I'm just trying to understand as we go forward, the alternatives would lessen, I guess, the project or affected project goals, but lessen the impacts. And are we taking steps, though, take any one of the three there that would incorporate elements of those that would still allow the project to go forward, but have stronger approaches to mitigation than otherwise would be if we didn't consider those alternatives?
I think in the case of the ag land preservation, and there are components of both the project and the alternative. So for example, the Good Neighbor Checklist idea, or not idea, the recommendation for the Good Neighbor Checklist that's a part of the project. It's part of the project and part of the alternative.
Okay.
So, I mean, the types of things that we would be doing in the alternative would be just, for example, reducing the amount of, just kind of straight reducing the amount of restoration that occurs on the landscape in the interest of preserving, maximizing preservation of agricultural land. So it attempts to address that trade-off and address it through the various different means that are proposed in the amendment.
Okay, that helps. It's clearer to me now, and you are recommending the Good Neighbor Checklist, but you know, more than just a checklist, obviously, to incorporate some of those aspects of
incorporating those principles.
Yeah, principles, right. Okay. All right. Thanks, Madam Chair. That's all I need. Thanks.
Certainly. Thank you, Don. Any other questions for Jeff? I have a question, Jeff, on the priority attributes. Could you put that in the context of the CEQA and the proposed project versus the alternatives?
There would be no difference between the project and the alternatives with regard to the inclusion of what we're referring to as ERPA, which incorporates those five components. The way the alternatives work is they're perhaps more, you know, we do talk about changes potentially to some of the recommendations and policies that would result in reduced acreage of restoration or in across the board reduced construction impacts, for example, because there are fewer potential restoration projects under those alternatives. But the ERPA policy would be part of the proposed project as well as all of the alternatives. So that
I see.
It wouldn't be directly impacted.
Okay. Thank you. Well, seeing no other council member questions, is there any public comment on this item?
There is, Madam Chair. We have Brett Baker. Brett, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Good morning, council members. I just have a few comments here on behalf of the Central Delta Water Agency. We will be submitting additional written comments by the deadline, the 30th next week after Thanksgiving. So I just wanted to start out by saying that we're not opponents to the idea of habitat restoration in general. We just want to see that these conflicts with current local land uses, flood protection, and water supply are minimized or not exacerbated to the extent that habitat restoration takes place. So along those lines, our main areas of concern are that there is no increased salinity intrusion as a result of these efforts that would include any changes to the Delta's hydrology or tidal prism, no increase in methylization of mercury. We don't want to do anything to inhibit or increase HAB formations. And likewise, we also want to reduce conflicts with flood control, like I stated earlier. There is some things regarding hatcheries, both salmonids and smelt. I'm a firm believer there's a lot of room for improvement in the way we hatchery rear fish in this estuary for salmonids, anadromous fish. As far as smelt, though, we do have concerns as to placing a hatchery reared smelt in the Delta. I think it's very important that you are cognizant of the location and timing of those releases to minimize any regulatory impacts, such as, you know, the operation of the State and Central Valley Project. In addition, you know, we are supportive of the idea of restoring Frank's Tract. I believe there's a right way and a wrong way to do it, or an effective and efficient way to do it. And then there's probably a costly, less effective way to do it. I would encourage the council to engage the local folks to come up with solutions that make sense there. Lastly, performance measures. I'm not a firm believer that just putting acreage targets out there is really a performance measure in and of itself. Ultimately, our last question is, we have submitted comments on Lookout Slough, and our main concern with any habitat restoration is it is properly funded and paid for by those who are responsible for the payment of it. We don't want to see any Delta levy money being taken or stolen to build habitat that doesn't help protect flood risk, reduce flood risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Any other public comments on this item?
There are, Madam Chair. I also have Ocean Reserve. OSHA, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Thank you. Good morning. OSHA Reserve with Local Agencies of the North Delta. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay. We're still in the process of reviewing the revised Chapter 4 as well as the program EIR. I was really looking, I guess, to see if some of the key comments that I had made on the 2020 draft were, I guess it's actually 2019 draft, were implemented. I'm a little concerned that some of them have not been addressed still, and I'll bring those up in a comment letter. I think just to touch on a few issues, you know, this figure 4-2 in the chapter, it really is showing a restored future landscape that for most parts of the Delta is not attainable. And, you know, when we're looking at areas that are in agricultural use, surrounded by levees, this idea of connecting the land to the water is not feasible and is in direct conflict with protecting the Delta, you know, the communities and the culture of the Delta. So, you know, I think that additional explanation around that in terms of limiting it to places where that would be actually possible without disrupting the existing communities would be really important and respectful of all the effort that's gone into the agricultural operations over, you know, the more than, I don't know, like 150 years or more. There's also, I think, an issue where there's not a connection back to the D-list policy and how that works together. And I know D-list is still under development, but or I guess it finally got adopted. So I think it would be a good time to go back and see if you could try to explain how the D-list policy jives with the restoration suggestions. There's a concern still about Stone Lakes National Wildlife Refuge being a priority restoration area. That's a National Wildlife Refuge designated by Congress. I don't think it's respectful to say that the DSC is suggesting something different than what the refuge manager is trying to carry out there under the refuge management plan. And I'm sure that the refuge manager could consult with your staff on the particulars of that. I think I tried to tee up that issue for you in comments before, and I couldn't see that that was addressed. We do appreciate the inclusion of the updated Good Neighbor Checklist. I'm very happy to see that, at least as a suggestion. May I just briefly conclude, Chair Tatian?
Yes, go ahead, Osha. Thank you.
I see my time's up, but I don't think there's that many people in line. So let's see. I think there's another issue that is kind of addressed in the Good Neighbor Checklist to a certain extent, but I think it's important for the council's materials to address it, is that there's ongoing maintenance needed for restoration projects. It's not a set it and forget it. And we see some restoration projects proposed by DWR or contractors or outside investment firms really want to come in and just build something and then just leave. And that's a real concern for the communities. And so I think for the council to be suggesting actively that, you know, the long-term maintenance is something that needs to be addressed would be very helpful in making sure these projects are successful and that ultimately the council's goals of promoting more restoration actually can be carried out. Obviously it's like weeds, trespass, you know, all kinds of access issues, you know, they can be addressed long-term, but I think someone needs to, you know, point that out. I think that's all I'll say for now, but I do appreciate the opportunity to comment and we'll try to get some writing in. Oh, one last thing. I will be checking the EIR to look at the emissions for the conversion for restoration for carbon sequestration. I know we've got an update on that next on the agenda. That is a big concern to me that that gets taken into account because putting in tule and other types of cover that has a big concern with methane emissions. And we need to make sure that we're weighing all the different kinds of emissions coming off of these types of projects. Again, they could be very beneficial, might be a good idea, but we need to make sure we're not just looking at one benefit and excluding other impacts that may occur. And that also includes taking away ag productivity. And that's where, you know, maybe things like rice are a little bit closer to something that would work in the Delta more so than the straight up tule. So anyway, thanks.
Thank you, Osha.
Chair Tatian?
Virginia, yes.
Thank you. Just a quick question. I don't know if Jessica or Ryan Just if you could give us a quick recap in terms of the next steps and the follow-up. I'm really interested in seeing, and there was a couple of speakers who just mentioned that they're going to be submitting some additional comments in a letter. When does all of this get wrapped into a public document, and what's the, I guess, the timeline for us to also be able to review these additional comments and feedback that we can consider with this new alternative that's being proposed?
Okay, I can respond to that if you'd like.
Yes, go ahead. Thank you, Jeff.
First, I just want to clarify, there's not a new alternative being proposed. We were talking about the range of alternatives that are defined in the EIR as a comparison to the project. So the proposed project remains as described in the presentation in the ecosystem amendment and in the EIR itself. What we're doing from here is on November 30th, so the Tuesday following Thanksgiving, November 30th, the public comment period for the draft environmental impact report closes. So a number of the speakers, for example, were referring to preparing written comments. They're doing that in response to that process, which we're anticipating those comments being submitted by the 30th. Staff will then take in the comments, itemize them, categorize them, prepare responses to each comment received, and those responses will be incorporated into a final environmental impact report. And then what will happen is we will bring the responses to comments, the final environmental impact report, and the ecosystem amendment itself to the council in the spring of 2022 for further review and discussion, at which point we would be asking the council to essentially at that point, that's when staff would be recommending certification of the final EIR and adoption of the plan. So those comments, again, will be coming in by the 30th. We will be itemizing and responding to them December, January, February. As we get into March and April of next year, we'll be looking at a timeframe for a council action to consider and move and potentially approve the EIR and the ecosystem amendment.
Thank you, Ryan, for that clarification and timeline. I appreciate that.
Okay, if there are no other public comments, I think we can consider that this item is concluded.
Madam Chair, I saw Matt Holmes had his hand up, but seems to have lowered it. I just wanted to make sure that that was Matt Conover.
Okay.
And Matt Holmes. Okay, now they're both raised. Okay, we'll start with Matt Holmes.
Yeah, sorry, I clicked the raise hand button. I wasn't sure. I'm here to comment on the carbon capture item, but I wasn't sure what item we're on right now because I was
Hi Matt. Yeah, we are not on carbon capture just yet.
Thanks. Sorry, I was at a Valley Air governing board meeting at the same time, so I'm in too many.
No, that's quite all right.
I'll put you in the queue for the next item. Matt Conover, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Hi, this is Matt Conover.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm in Cosumnes River floodplain across from the McCormick-Williamson Tract, Twin Cities Road, west of I-5, about a mile and a half, and the spot where the Cosumnes River dumps into the Delta in the northeast corner of the Delta. I've presented to you at other meetings as well as to other agencies, and haven't seen much responsiveness. I've called staff, including Jeff Henderson and lady who runs Delta Adapts, and repeated the same thing over and over and haven't seen any changes. I haven't yet read this, and I'm hoping that when I do, it'll have something that acknowledges at a lower policy level the economic impacts created by these policy changes. One might be the Delta Adapts policy impact analysis made in general about letting lower-lying islands overtop the levees as sea level rises. But there's no discussion of whether those farmers can make a living and stay feasible with their recommendation of just shifting their crop mix to salt-tolerant species. There needs to be some economic impact analysis, socioeconomics of population displacement, and modeling of the impacts of this, getting it down off this high policy level to real human impacts. Human dimensions was mentioned earlier by the Science Board, and should look at the impacts of flooding, breaking Lost Slough Levee, and flooding everything up through RD 1002 parallel to I-5 and Morrison impacts, and the backup flooding caused by Nature Conservancy's projects on up and down the Cosumnes River and using us as the floodplain basin. And it's affecting Point Pleasant, closed I-5 for months, a flood several years ago. And that's my main comment, and I'll write it up if you'd like. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Conover. We would appreciate if you have the time to receive your comments in writing. So one last check for public comments on this item.
I believe that concludes the public comments from this item.
All right, thank you, Beck. Well, in that case, thank you very much, Jeff, for a great overview. We'll move on to agenda item 9, carbon capture and storage in the Delta. Jessica Pearson will give us a quick introduction.
Okay, thank you, Chair Tatayan. Can you hear me this time?
Yes.
Great. As the state works towards reducing greenhouse gases to address climate change, carbon capture and storage has been presented as an option for achieving that goal. Of particular note to the council is that the Delta has been recently identified as a potential site for carbon storage, and programs are being considered by local landowners who may participate in these future carbon storage projects. So today's representatives are working in this space and are going to share their knowledge with us. I welcome Jeff back to introduce our panelists for our carbon capture and storage in the Delta panel. Jeff?
Thank you, Jessica. I'd like to in turn welcome our guests today who will be speaking to us regarding the emergence of carbon capture and storage technology. Campbell Ingram from the Delta Conservancy will provide a general context for carbon capture and storage and current ongoing management efforts at the state level. George Paredes from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory will describe the potential of the Delta for carbon storage and briefly summarize results of a recent community survey. And then Tom Zuckerman will provide landowner perspectives on the potential for carbon storage in the Delta. And then I'll close the presentation by summarizing environmental justice concerns and addressing the relevance of carbon storage to the Delta plan and other council initiatives. And this morning we'll begin with Campbell. Welcome, Campbell.
Found the mute button. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Chair Tatayan and council members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about carbon capture storage in the Delta. First, I want to make a very clear distinction. On numerous occasions, I've come before the council and I've talked about work in the Delta that is trying to address surface subsidence and the resulting carbon emissions that result from that by incentivizing rice cultivation and managed wetlands and engaging the carbon market. That work continues and is making progress, but that is not what we're talking about today. We are talking about capturing carbon from various sources and storing it well below the surface, in some cases up to close to 2 miles below the surface of the Delta. So when we're talking about this, we are looking at emission sources where carbon can be captured readily. And so we're talking about industrial sources such as electricity generation, hydrogen production, cement production, and even petroleum refinement. There's also the opportunity to consider forest waste. We know that in California, we have a tremendous amount of forest treatment that needs to be happened. The waste byproducts can be turned into other products that keep carbon from going into the atmosphere. And those processes actually generate carbon to make those conversions, and we can capture that carbon. We also know that up and down the Central Valley, we have tremendous amounts of agricultural waste byproduct, trimming of orchards and just all manner of waste product that needs to be addressed. Again, we can turn that into other products, valuable products, and capture the carbon in that process, and then look for places to store that. And then we also know that to meet our carbon objectives, we may actually need to capture carbon directly from the atmosphere. So really what we're talking about is looking at all of those sources, trying to capture those carbon from those sources, compress it, transport it, and store it below ground in the Delta. And I do want to mention that this is a technology that has been successfully employed in other parts of the world. And as Jeff mentioned, George is going to come on in a few minutes and talk very specifically about why the Delta is such a prime opportunity for this activity. So the current situation in the Delta, there's just a lot of activity in this space, and that's why we wanted to present to you today. There are significant drivers. The companies that employ these industrial processes want to reduce their carbon footprint. They also have requirements to reduce their carbon emissions. And so they're looking for a place to put their carbon. They have access potentially to the low carbon fuel standard, which results in a $200 per ton of stored carbon revenue stream. And they also have access to the 45Q tax credit, which is approximately a $50 per ton amount. And that tax credit is actually being considered to convert to a more of a direct incentive that could be close to $80 per ton. So you can see a pretty significant revenue stream, which I think is really important when you consider agricultural waste and forest product waste, which heretofore have been really, you know, challenging economically because of transportation costs to think about how we handle those waste products. So given that revenue stream and the prime real estate that we have in the Delta, it's created a lot of activity. There's five or more companies out there that are actively engaging with Delta landowners, private landowners, NGOs, and even state landowners. And they're trying to develop pilot projects with the expectation that one or more of these projects might actually go to permitting sometime in the next 6 to 12 months. In addition, there are about 10 agencies that have some level of regulatory oversight or permitting that would be associated with this, including the Delta Stewardship Council that would be looking at consistency with the Delta plan. So given all of this activity, we thought that it was important to try to enhance some coordination. And so we put together what we call the Delta Carbon Capture Coordination Group. And that group has met twice now. And the group is initially, and it brings together the landowners, the companies, as well as the regulating entities. And the group has really been focusing on three primary topics so far. First is commissioning an independent economic analysis. We currently have a scope of work and we're seeking funding to actually do the analysis. But the intent here is to help everyone understand all of the costs, right? So what are the actual costs of developing the technology to capture carbon from all those sources that we mentioned? What is the cost of transporting that carbon, drilling the wells, pumping the carbon into the ground, and then doing the monitoring that will be required? How do those costs relate to the revenue streams that we talked about, and what therefore would be a reasonable expectation for Delta landowners and the region in general? What sort of revenue streams might this actually result in for the Delta for all of the issues that we think are important and need revenue to help keep the Delta economically viable? Another focus point of the group is outreach. So we all know that the Delta is a challenging environment for all the reasons that we deal with on a daily basis. So it's really important that we have a coordinated outreach strategy and coordinated messaging to help the Delta community understand this technology, understand the potential benefits, understand any risks, but also even more broadly than just the Delta community. Obviously, we need local support, so that requires understanding, even beyond just the Delta, the California and even the nation, you know, understand these processes. And then the last focus of the group really is you know, the regulatory process. As I mentioned, 10 plus agencies, there's a real opportunity there for some level of streamlining for permitting, coordination of permitting, and just really understanding all those processes. So that's what I wanted to present, just an overview of what's happening in the Delta right now. And I will now turn it over to George for more focus on why we're looking at the Delta for these issues. Thank you.
And if you could please add the presentation. Thank you.
All right, so while we're getting set up here with the presentation, good morning, everyone. Thanks, Campbell, for the introduction. Jeff, Chatterstein, it's great to be here. Very short amount of time to cover what is undoubtedly a complex topic, so I'll do my best to introduce the basics, and hopefully that will provide an avenue to people asking more questions. We're more than happy to field them today, or if we run out of time offline, so please do get in touch with us. Next slide, please. So why are we talking about putting CO2 underground to begin with? This is as you probably know, California has set itself the goal to be carbon neutral by 2045 or earlier. And this is a serious effort. And what it's going to take is a lot more of what we have been doing already. So renewable energy, solar panels, wind turbines, electrification of vehicles, more efficient buildings. But it's going to take a lot more than that. We're going to have to redouble and intensify efforts in the areas that we have championed, but we're going to have to do more. And if you could just click on gradually here, and there are some pop-ups. We're going to have to move CO2, capture CO2 from existing large point sources, but we're also going to have to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And there are several ways of doing that. Some involve machines, some involved using agricultural residue or waste, like Campbell just mentioned, or the fuel reduction projects that are taking place in our forests to reduce wildfire risk can also be turned into carbon negative fuels and displace fossil fuels. And ultimately, the reason that we need to remove from the atmosphere is we're going to have residual emissions. And where do these come from? If you could just gradually click through, well, we're going to have agriculture. It's hard to mitigate. Just keep clicking. Wildfires, cattle farming, applications like aviation do not lend themselves to being electrified readily. Heavy trucking, cement production. These are applications that you could not readily eliminate or have carbon-free substitutes for. So that leads us to believe that we're going to need a finite, you know, this is not a get out of jail free card to not do other types of climate mitigation, but we are going to also have to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. Where does that CO2 go? Well, it has to go back where it came from, and that's underground. So next slide, please. When we say underground, as Campbell mentioned, we're not talking near shallow groundwater horizons. We're talking at least a mile deep, if not more. Several areas in the Delta, primary injection targets would be 6,000 to 10,000 feet deep. The kind of rock where you inject CO2 is very much like Western or Southwestern desert sandstone. So you're seeing some desert sandstone towers here on the top right. That is the kind of rock that accommodates the CO2. And we're showing a zoomed in version on the bottom right. So don't imagine large spaces or voids or caverns that we fill up with CO2. The CO2 goes in these microscopic pore spaces between the grains that make up these rocks. There are many processes that trap the CO2 down there and consolidate its location and don't let it move or escape. And just for context, and one more click, please. Nature has trapped fluids in some cases for up to hundreds of millions of years. That's 1,000 times longer than the human species as we know today, Homo sapiens, has been on the planet. And the reason that we have brines, oil, gas on the ground that people have been extracting is because nature has trapped these fluids for millions to hundreds of millions of years. So even though we only recently thought of it as a climate mitigation effort, really it's a natural process that has been happening for a while. Next slide, please. People ask, okay, how experimental is this? How much of it has been done around the world? This shows you a map of projects around the globe. The size of each circle represents the scale of the project. 1 million tons being the empty circle on the bottom left per year. And the color represents the stage of development. So this is not ubiquitous by any means, but it's also not experimental. It's been happening for decades in some cases. And there are several facilities around the globe in Asia and North America, which is the champion really of this technology, in Europe and also in the Middle East. In Australia, I think, is one of the biggest projects recently opened. So there are a fair amount of plants that you can go and visit and see this happen in practice. Next slide, please. Tying it back to the Delta here in the local context. So I want to impress on you how unique the geology is in the Delta and in the Central Valley of California more generally. So on the map of the left, you see, you know, a very pronounced sedimentary valley basin that is bounded by all kinds of more funky stuff, geologically speaking. And if you look on the map on the right by the U.S. Geologic Survey, this corresponds depth to basement rock. So blue is shallow and pink is deep. You will see that the Central Valley really stands out from a geological standpoint. It's several thousand feet deep. These are, you know, the same processes that geologically that gave rise to this amazing, unique ecosystem of the Delta have also created a sedimentary basin. The runoff from the mountains, from the Sierra, has carried with it sediments over millions of years that are very deep. They're relatively young in age. So as we move towards the Rockies, things get older and certainly more complex in some cases. Young means less consolidated, i.e. with a lot of space to put CO2 in. So from a geological standpoint, the Central Valley is a unique gift, if you like, for doing something about climate. And the Delta itself, you know, we zoomed in and did some focus research on the Delta, and it really has a tremendous resource to store CO2, probably many, many decades worth of CO2 in terms of California's climate emissions. Now, that's both a challenge, it has to be managed responsibly, but it's also an opportunity to serve many causes at once, both local and community needs and development, but also the state's climate goals. So next slide, please. This gives you a cross-section that runs through the Delta, and it's a typical what's called layer cake geology setting. The gray areas that you see, these are impermeable rocks that help in trapping the CO2 in place and limit its movement, typically things like shales. The yellow layers that you see are sandstones, and these are the ones that have the pore space that can accommodate the CO2. That slanted line sort of on the left third is the Midland Fault. So things do change. That runs through the Central Delta, and there's a depth offset there. But as you can see, you know, this cross-section of the Sacramento Basin lays out a situation that many other states would drool over from a geological standpoint. It really is textbook geology to safely and permanently put CO2 away deep underground. Next slide, please. What does this thing look like? How much infrastructure do we need? The answer is not much. A single well can inject a million tons of CO2, which is quite a bit. I think California's entire emissions these days, discounting wildfires, are in the mid 400 million tons per year region. So a single well can do a lot in good geology, and the Delta does have that geology. The footprint is small and very similar to existing gas wells in the Delta. So on the top right is a photo that I took. I think this is in the vicinity of Bolden Island. It's an old gas well with a fairly decrepit looking fence and a handwritten sign. The bottom two photos show you injection wells from geologic storage projects around the country. One is in Illinois, the other one is in Saskatchewan, or the continent, I should say. So you will see that in terms of size, they're not really that different. In terms of degree of modernity and maintenance status, you'll see that these are much better looked after. The gas well is has seen better days. So driving around the Delta, you'll see, you know, tens or even hundreds of these gas wells. We are not talking about adding anywhere near that many. You would also need one or two injection wells per project. So really the surface footprint is minimal, and it doesn't compete with any ongoing agricultural, conservation, or other surface objectives or activities. Next slide, please. Not much is known about this technology. So we undertook a bit of social science research to figure out what people know about this and what their attitudes are. You know, we're very conscious that we are technologists and we do not know or comprehend the local community dimensions, and that we need to be educated on those. So as a start on this process, we commissioned some research about public attitudes, and we did this in the Delta and in Kern County. This consisted of in-depth interviews. You know, these may have gone on probably for an hour longer, talking about priorities of locals. These included local stakeholders, landowners, business owners, researchers. I do not know who was interviewed. This is confidential. Some of you may be on that list, but I wouldn't know. This is safeguarded information. And we also did, the firm responsible, FM3, did quantitative interviews. So these are more like what you would think of as a survey with registered voters in the Greater Delta area. And there were approaching 650. I cannot possibly take you through the whole suite of results, but I'm sending a YouTube link where you can hear it from Dave Metz from the Horse's Mouth, who coordinated and ran some of this research. I do recommend that you watch it. It's very interesting. And last slide, the highest possible level conclusions from that research is that voters in the Delta are largely unfamiliar with the concept of geologic carbon storage. Once they're presented with more information about what it is and how it works, they have generally positive but cautious reactions. And their ambivalence is driven by the fact that this is likely the first time that they hear about this. This is not an idea that has circulated before that people are aware of. Now, that's changing for the reasons that Campbell mentioned. There are significant revenue streams for this and potential revenues to landowners. And as a result, project developers are looking to develop projects in the region and approaching landowners. Projects close to home were seen by voters as less appealing than projects further away. So there is a trepidation about having these projects in one's own vicinity. People expressed pretty uniformly a desire to have extensive regulation and public input for these projects, but also a desire to see permanent jobs flow as a result of these projects. And then in terms of who are the believable or trusted messengers to deliver information on the technology, the most trusted, among the most trusted were farming and ranching families, doctors and nurses, firefighters and research institutions. On the least trusted side of the spectrum, you have the project developers themselves and industry. And I hate to admit it, but it is a result nonetheless, state government. So that concludes the presentation. Hopefully that raises a questions. I know that we have very limited time to cover other aspects like risk and regulation and track record. So more than happy to follow up offline with anyone who's interested. Thank you very much for having me.
Chair. Now, Chair, I just had a question on the slide.
Oh, certainly, Don.
Yeah, just if I go back to just slide, the previous slide, George. Yeah, on your quantitative interviews, I see San Joaquin, Contra Costa, and Solano counties referenced there by virtue of the municipalities and places. You know, I have some general awareness and certainly have been, as a local representative and representing Sacramento County, you know, with one of the hats that I wear as a member of the Board of Supervisors. I guess I'm curious, was there any interviews with folks, well, I see remainder, maybe in Sacramento County, because I know folks have been talking about Sherman and Twitchell Islands, which are, you know, geographically in Sacramento County, and, you know, some of these projects may have their, you know, their initiation in some of the areas that you interviewed in. But I'm just curious, you didn't do the interviews, but I'm curious, George, was there some outreach to folks in the Delta portions of Sacramento County?
Yeah, so these are just sample
okay.
towns mentioned here. Geographically, from south to north, we covered the Pittsburgh to Antioch stretch, so north of four, and we went at least as far north as the northern end of Staten, and then east to west. I think we went from the western tip of Sherman Island to I-5.
Okay, so you got some, okay, so you have, it's not densely populated, but you have state holdings there that are significant on two islands I mentioned, but
correct.
There are a lot of in-holdings and certainly folks who, you know, and we say registered voters, but whether you're a registered voter or not, you're a resident and or a business owner. And so I just wanted to be sure that in the survey that you did, you know, take in portions of the Delta that included some of the reaches upstream, and it sounds like you have. So I appreciate the clarification. Good. Thank you.
I have a question. This is Maria. I'm just wondering, you know, knowing the environmental landscape and everything, what is your experience and how much have you learned about first, really, I mean, what does this do to water underground? What does it do environmentally, the whole issue of safety, health hazard? And then, of course, how the communities are going to maybe have questions, maybe resist, maybe just because of the unknown factor, maybe. And maybe it is known, but what is your experience in some of those issues that you know?
Yeah, so the relation with groundwater, as we said, you know, you're injecting thousands of feet underground, so you're going well below the groundwater horizon. The key here is picking the right sites and executing correctly. Mm-hmm. So you can do this badly or you can do it well. I'm happy to report that in a previous life in the NGO world, we succeeded in some of our advocacy in getting people to adopt really stringent regulations for this.
Mm-hmm.
And the regulations are, they date back from 2010, the federal EPA regulations, and the state ones date back to January 1st of 2019. And these were based quite heavily on learnings from where oil and gas regulation has failed in the past. There is a very heavy degree of scrutiny on injection permitting. Oil and gas permits are handed over by, you know, there are thousands in some cases every year.
Mm.
since 2010, there have been, I believe, 5 CO2 injection wells permitted nationwide. So, you know, really these are looked at very carefully. It takes years to get a permit like this. You know, EPA said we aspire to turn a permit around in 2 years. The previous examples from Illinois, that took closer to 3 or 4. So, you know, these are cumbersome things and really do bear no relation to oil and gas regulation. Does that mean that something cannot go wrong? No. And that is where other people, communities, external watchdogs would be extremely useful. Mm-hmm. The emphasis is on prevention, so picking the right site to make sure that you don't have leakage pathways. Having looked at this for 15, 20 years, and the U.S. Department of Energy has been sponsoring research in that area for at least 2 decades now, the conclusion that we have largely reached is that leakage is not the prime concern here, and that even though, you know, this is intuitively what people are worried about, a greater concern is not inducing seismicity, so not causing earthquakes. So from a science point of view, that is a greater concern. The good news is that this can be managed, and you run into trouble when your basement rock is shallow, and that's what, or when you inject too close to it. That's what happened, for example, in Oklahoma, where they were fracking for oil and gas, and they caused a whole bunch of shakes. This can be avoided quite readily in the Delta because basement rock is so deep. And so you have multiple buffer zones between basement and where you would be injecting the CO2. Not only do you have distance from the surface to keep you away from groundwater, but you also have distance from the bottom. And you know, this is where the Delta is so unique. You have these really deep sediments, which give you that flexibility. I know that it's hard to convince someone of this. So to your, the second part of your question, you know, how will locals react to this? I don't know. I think they can bring a perspective that scientists may not have, and that's both desirable and healthy. From our point of view as scientists, we do not take this lightly, and we have many decades worth of experience and data and research and practical application to base our statements when we say that, yes, we do have confidence that this will work.
George, thanks. I think, first of all, the presentation was outstanding, was very informative. And I think you covered the answer to my question. This was a very good presentation. Thank you.
Sure. Chair Tatian, if I could, we do have 2 additional sort of smaller parts of this presentation, if it'd be possible to table questions until the end.
Certainly, yeah.
Okay. I'd like to invite Tom Zuckerman to unmute and provide landowner perspectives on the potential for use of carbon capture and storage in the Delta. Tom? Brandon, can you unmute Tom?
We can ask him to unmute.
There we go.
Now you can hear me?
Yes.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here once again before the Stewardship Council in a somewhat different capacity than historically has been the case. And I appreciate the opportunity to represent the viewpoint of the landowners and farmers in the Delta on this important subject. And I'm a relative newcomer to the subject, introduced to it by George Paredes 2 years ago, and I've been working continuously on opportunities in the Delta with both George and with Campbell over that period of time. From a Delta landowner perspective, this is a huge emerging opportunity for preservation of the Delta. And think of it in terms of not a permanent solution, but a transitory or transition solution to try to take care of the unavoidable emissions that are taking place while we transition away from fossil fuels over a period of years. But the Delta appears to have a very large capacity in terms of looking at other opportunities around the United States and the world to make a real dent in the, particularly the regional emissions that are so heavily concentrated in the North Contra Costa shore with all the oil and industrial gas facilities, and also transportation opportunities through the Port of Stockton that would avail themselves to projects in the Delta. It's important to understand that one of the things that we're all concerned about in the Delta is sea level rise. Sea level rise is a product of global warming. Global warming is a product of greenhouse gas emissions. And to have an opportunity here directly to not only improve the world's health so in its in some fashion, but also to contribute to the stopping of global warming and sea level rise is going to be especially important to those of us who are worried about preserving the Delta for agriculture, for recreation, and for its environment. There will be income streams available, portions of which could be siphoned off by the state, if you will, in return for the use of storage space that's actually owned by the state as a result of ownership of the bottom of navigable channels and other acquisitions that the state and other public agencies have made in the Delta. So we're actually supporting the idea of some sort of a sharing on an equitable basis of whatever revenue streams might occur for the storage, so that a fund could be created to help maintain levees, to provide public access, to enhance environmental circumstances in the Delta through this. So it would be a win-win-win situation for everybody. The geology is great, as George Paredes has described to you. The geography is really good in the sense of proximity to the areas that are heavily producing greenhouse gas emissions in Northern California and in the Central Valley. And we have a bit of an advantage also, because these are vast areas that will be involved in terms of creating these plumes underground, that we have some historical coordination of land ownership in the Delta through reclamation districts, where the landowners of individual islands have cooperated historically for levee building and drainage and so forth. So we have kind of a head start on getting cooperation amongst various landowners that's going to be necessary to cover the region that'll be affected by individual projects. That's basically what I wanted to talk about. There are ongoing efforts. I particularly have been involved in what you might call grassroots efforts up from the Delta that are more concerned about preserving the income streams from this. There are other efforts that are being promoted by some of the more prominent emitters. It's really important, I think, that this project that was described, to try to get independent studies done to know what an equitable proportion of the revenue stream that might be available for deep carbon sequestration, how that might best be shared by the landowners, by the state, and by the actual emitters. One of the things that I wanted to comment on is that people are concerned in many instances when you look at the cradle to death analysis of carbon production, about transportation. When you start talking about moving CO2 from a site where it's being emitted to the site where it's going to be stored, how are you going to do that? And in the Delta, we have an extra opportunity to utilize waterborne transport with modern equipment and so forth that is not emittive. And it's sort of reminiscent of what the ports were trying to do a few years ago with the marine highway thing, where they were trying to take truck traffic off of the highways in favor of moving containers by barges and so forth. That opportunity applies to most of the areas in the Delta, which are readily accessible by barge transport, shallow draft barges. And I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to try to answer any questions that you might have. And I'm very anxious to see this going forward. And I think I speak on behalf of all of the landowners in the Delta who are cognizant of this opportunity.
Thank you, Tom. And then I'll just close this out with summarizing the environmental justice concerns and relating carbon capture and storage to the Delta plan. As noted in your staff report, while these types of projects do enable progress toward achieving greenhouse gas reduction goals, they also have numerous impacts that we need to consider and avoid or mitigate where possible, including potentially prolonging reliance on fossil fuels and continuing or exacerbating existing environmental justice and public health issues that are associated with point source pollution. While the scope of our work is still being determined, the impacts of these types of projects will likely be considered as an important issue in the Council's ongoing environmental justice issue paper initiative. With regard to the Delta plan, given the geologic potential of the Delta for this technology and California's aggressive emissions reduction goals, several future projects, as we've heard described here, may be proposed in the Delta, and many of these may meet the definition of a covered action that would be required to demonstrate consistency with the Delta plan. The types of factors to consider in the context of the Delta plan related to these projects could include things like the potential use of pipelines, barges, trucks, or rail to transport carbon to storage sites in the Delta, the potential to extend existing environmental justice and public health impacts, and the potential for agricultural land conversion to support infrastructure required at storage sites. Given the current understanding of these projects, we anticipate that several would be covered actions that would implicate several Delta plan policies that are described further in your staff report. Our staff will continue to engage with the Resources Agency and other agency partners to understand the details and the impacts of these projects, and will advise project proponents regarding the Delta plan regulations at early points in the development of these projects. And I'd like to thank our presenters today for setting a background for this work, and I very much anticipate we'll be discussing these types of projects again in the future. And that concludes the presentation. Happy to entertain questions and public and we're looking forward as well to public comments.
Great, thank you, Jeff. And thank you to the panel members. I agree with Maria, this is an excellent presentation. I think I need much more education. I'm very curious now. Council members, any questions?
Sure.
Don.
Yeah, just very quickly, and again, I would add my thanks to both yours and Maria's presentation and certainly thank our presenters. I do think that in addition to, back to my question earlier about the survey and so forth, that it'll be important in going forward. I think certainly the council's role is a very important one, and I appreciate Jeff's highlighting that as well. But I think certainly at the local level, and I know Mr. Zuckerman mentioned obviously reclamation districts. I think your cities and counties who oftentimes may or may not be in alignment with what the state and or other entities are pressing forward with, not so much about the idea itself, but I think with the revenue sharing and some of the impacts, both positive but potentially negative, and or ways that those revenues, assuming this were acceptable from the standpoint of all the regulatory and permitting processes that would allow a project or projects to go forward. But I think, you know, Mr. Zuckerman made some really good points about levies, about the road infrastructure, and certainly access to the surface level attributes, certainly environmental, recreational, agricultural, and just daily life in the Delta. And so I think it'll be important, if not imperative, that in going forward, that connectivity with local governments, and whether it be special districts and or municipalities and county jurisdictions, along with obviously state agencies and this council and its role, certainly Delta Protection Commission and the Delta Conservancy. And I thank Campbell for his leadership as well. I know, Campbell, you've been very instrumental in, as you said, pulling together a coordinated approach. And so I have confidence that, you know, the makings are there, but I just would further emphasize, I think that's important. And I don't know if Campbell, maybe you wanted to weigh in, because I know you spent a lot of time along with others from the Conservancy Board, but certainly in working with George and Jeff and in this case, Tom and other landowners. So it might be helpful just if you could highlight just for a moment, Campbell, not so much a question, but just can we reemphasize kind of that approach going forward, because I think that's going to be key and critical, not just to the acceptance of this, but also obviously, I think, you know what it is and, you know, for the length of time that obviously would be involved here, probably eons, you know, once the projects are put in place. And so I think knowing what that approach will be going forward will be really important. And again, kudos to those who presented today. So I don't know, Campbell, if there's anything you wanted to add. I didn't frame it like a question, but I wanted to emphasize the point. So thanks, Madam Chair.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think we've in terms of that coordination group, we've reached out to the counties to try to help them understand the future potential. I think, you know, there's more work to be done in terms of a coordinated outreach strategy to get more to the local communities and cities in the future. And I think, you know, that is a focal point. I think the group's really trying to think about how best to do that, and then the best timing to do that too. So I think, you know, maybe the short answer is that we're cognizant that we're going to need that kind of awareness and involvement and participation. And so we're really, focused on that and trying to think about the best ways to do that collectively.
Thanks. That's all I had, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Are there other questions from council members? I have a question, and not that the answer is readily available, or maybe it is in your literature and in your research. But before I ask the question, I really appreciate that this group coordinating these efforts took the time to do the social research and get context on what the local communities is thinking and feeling about such an endeavor. My question has to do with a worst case scenario. So the seismic activity inducement that you spoke of, George. My understanding from what was presented is this has been successfully deployed, and when these sorts of projects are done correctly, risk is minimal. But has anyone studied the probability of inducing seismic activity in the Delta from how many of these projects? I mean, would one do it? Would five? Just trying to get a handle on it.
Yeah, large teams have focused on this for years now. We have to draw a distinction between, you know, causing an earthquake of the magnitude that, for example, the Hayward Fault could cause by itself naturally, which could cause a lot of damage, and causing an earthquake which would be felt at the surface and which would raise question marks but wouldn't necessarily cause any damage. Now, we think that clearly the severe scenario is unacceptable. We think that the other one is unacceptable too. Even if you cause a shake that can be felt at the surface but doesn't do damage, we think that's avoidable. And it's a sign that the operator isn't paying attention, not doing the things that they should be doing. So yes, this is avoidable. There are many people looking into this. There are models that have been built to manage the risk of seismicity. The first thing you do is you look at the history, the natural history of the sites. Is there any naturally occurring seismicity that would give away the presence of faults that are in danger of slipping if you start increasing the pressure in the subsurface? If you have an area that's naturally quiet, that's an indication that your risk is lower. If you wanted to inject next to the Hayward or the San Andreas faults, then you should not be allowed to do this, of course. The other thing is, after you've looked at the natural seismic history of the place, is you look at the vicinity to existing faults and the vicinity to basement. So in the cases where people have caused earthquakes from oil and gas extraction, they were dangerously close to basement rock and their pressures were exceeding what was prudent. And that was largely, I don't know whether they were out of compliance, but if I remember correctly, I think that was because maybe there wasn't a strong enough requirement to watch out for these things. Now, seismicity prevention is built in to any permitting and authorization process that projects would have to go through. And we also have some evidence from Japan of how the geologic layers that contain CO2, but also existing CO2 wells behaved after a large natural earthquake. So I think the Nagaoka earthquake was 6.1 or 6.2 magnitude. So, you know, pretty large. And there was a CO2 injection well on site. It was examined after the earthquake as well, and they didn't find any integrity issues. Now, does that mean that nothing could ever go wrong? No, but as you start stacking the odds in your favor, we think that you can stay well clear of the danger of seismicity.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, George.
Susan, could I ask a question?
Oh, certainly, Virginia.
Thank you so much. Going back to what we were discussing, if you could just share briefly, because I'm going to run out of battery and I apologize. How does this impact existing projects and the future monitoring of these projects? And then how do we ensure this in terms of in perpetuity? How do we ensure and safeguard these projects?
Is this a question for me?
Yes, I'm so sorry. Yes.
Okay, sorry, my apologies. What kind of projects are you thinking of, council member?
Well, just existing projects that we have right now on hand.
So conservation projects or Delta conveyance, is that what you're thinking of?
Correct.
Okay, understood. I think the interaction...
I was just going to say, but more specifically with regard to our six permitted projects that we already have on hand.
So I see this as something that can be a non-intrusive neighbor. Because this happens so deep, it doesn't interfere with any surface or even shallow subsurface activities. So farming, conservation, even soil, carbon sequestration, these would not be affected. I'm by no means taking a position on Delta conveyance here, but the activities of that, again, would be much shallower. Any engineering related to that would not interfere with storing CO2, you know, 6, 7, 8,000 feet underground, where there may be some interference and where, you know, endangered species considerations or local considerations may come into is during construction. So at some point you will have to drill one or two wells. That means that a rig has to come in. A small area will need to be ring fenced. If you need to build a docking station somewhere on the channel, then again, these are minor construction projects that I don't see them as different to other activities that may take place. But so we're not talking about any large intrusion or interference.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that explanation.
You're welcome.
Jessica, you have your hand raised.
Thank you. Yeah, and it, maybe what Councilmember Madueño was getting at, but the in perpetuity, I think she referenced is, you know, how is that managed and guaranteed and what kind of agreements or funding are in place to ensure, you know, the permanent storage? And can you talk about that, particularly with examples of, I think you said there were a few permitted nationally, a few permitted projects of this type already, and maybe, you know, what you're seeing there and what we're learning there.
Right. So the risk profile for a project like this is a bell curve. So it goes up and then it dips again. The point of most interest is right when you stop injecting. That's when your risk is highest. That's when your pressure is highest. That's the peak of putting CO2 underground. After you stop, and gradually that pressure dissipates and the risk gradually tails off. Now, that doesn't mean that it drops to zero straight away. As a result of that, EPA and the Air Resources Board have placed different but compatible requirements on projects. EPA requires you to monitor the CO2 for at least 50 years after you stop injecting. CARB requires you to monitor it for 100 years after you stop injecting. In addition to that, you have a site decommissioning plan. So when you submit an application to get your permit, you have to say what you're going to do after the project is over, to plug and abandon the wells, cement them, remove any other infrastructure. You need to have an emergency and remedial response plan. And you also need to have financial assurance in place. So both agencies require their own financial assurance requirements. So that means that there are different financial instruments that you can use, but the gist of them is that you need to show either that you have the capability or that you have set a pool of money aside to deal with things that may come up. And you're on the hook for performing these tasks for a number of years.
That's helpful. Thank you. And if I can just add one more question, which I think is really for all the panelists, and that is, you know, what role do you envision for the council aside from our existing authorities? Are there holes in the regulatory patchwork for these projects that the council can fill, or maybe it's non-regulatory and it's something else, but open to those suggestions now or when they occur to you to contact us?
Maybe I'll just say, you know, very quickly, I mean, we appreciate Jeff's participation in the coordination group and looking for those opportunities around those three focal areas and thinking about funding and outreach capacity, those type of issues. So I think I just appreciate the coordination to date and look forward to continuing and keeping the council informed of where that leads us.
Well, if there are no other council questions or comments, is there any public comment?
There is. We have Matt Holmes.
Boy, I hope I'm not alone. Hi, everybody. Thanks for that panel. Nice to see you again, George. You got some new slides. I appreciate those. We were confused in earlier presentations about how deep 4,000 feet really is. So I like that slide in particular. So here to represent South Stockton, Little Manila Rising. We're concerned about this strategy. We're not Puritans about it. We're not going to read the label on the fire extinguisher, right? We're going to put out the fire on our house, I think is the example we used before. And if this is the only strategy to protect our community, we'll reach for it. We are worried that, you know, some of the questions that I'm relieved to hear this council ask weren't asked in some of the modeling, like what is the worst case scenario? Not just seismic, but what's a slow leak look like? What's a slow leak of supercritical CO2 that freezes the soil above it and distributes and disperses throughout the Delta and spikes the pH of this estuary? You know, we all know, everybody did the science project in high school where you blow into the pH solution. Spiking the pH of the estuary would be a crime that would be unrepairable for eons. And so I haven't seen the modeling that I need to see on that. And I don't think anybody can make an informed choice about this topic without seeing that worst case modeling done. And so, you know, we're talking to George and their team about getting that done, trying to work with the National Renewable Energy Lab, the DOE folks on their CLEAP program to pay for that modeling. We don't think anybody can make a choice until they've seen that. As to the question, I think it was Jessica just asked about what the council can do. I'd love to see you guys sort of break down the silos between CARB and the Natural Resources Agency. We sit on the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee for the scoping plan that's going to pony up $240 per ton. Let's be perfectly clear. That's the only reason anybody's looking at this. The state of California is removing the risk from exploring this unproven technology. I'd rather give $240 per square foot to Campbell to restore the whole Delta and fill it with the proven biological solutions that stabilize this planet for eons before we jump to a clever engineering solution. I think this has a lot of traction because folks at CARB are engineers and they know how to write down numbers on paper and they know how to show reductions. You know, I have to tell you, they haven't been really good at following up on those reductions and enforcing them in the rest of their portfolio of policies. I also want to thank George for calling out that these CO2 injection wells meet a much higher degree of scrutiny for permitting. But I will also say that in South Stockton, we know there's a big difference between scientific controls and industrial practices. Industrial partners in our region make all of their money by cutting corners, exploiting labor and the environment. That's where they make their coin. So we need to be really shrewd about this. And we're really glad to see folks like Tom who are locals. We'd much rather have locals be involved in this than DTE. But with that said, I've never met Tom's great-great-grandson. And so these are things that are going to require monitoring for decades. And this really isn't like a discrete arrangement between the state, the council, and a private landowner. This is a utility scale strategy that's going to need the public to have toeholds on it for forever. So happy to talk more about this and the intersections with the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee. And would rather fund everything at the Delta Conservancy before we try this moonshot.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Mr. Holmes, for taking the time to comment today. And I really appreciate your engagement with our environmental justice folks working on the white paper and on this topic. And are there any other public comments, Beck?
There are, Madam Chair. We also have OSHA Missouri.
Hi again, OSHA Missouri, local agencies of the North Delta. I'll be quick because I'm supposed to be on another call right now, and so I won't be able to stick around for any further, but I thought this was a really good presentation. I'm glad the council is, getting up to speed on these projects. I think my biggest concern is, you know, if these type of projects happen in the Delta, how the carbon dioxide would be transported to whatever locations that's stored at. And I just think with the roads and bridges, the way they are in the community, you know, coming by truck is a non-starter. I think barges are a non-starter, a lot of it because of the emissions. And you just got to think about, like, what's the net benefit if you're going to be burning fossil fuels to move carbon dioxide to a different location that's supposedly helping fight greenhouse gas emissions. So I know folks, I'm sure, are looking at that net benefit issue, but I think that, as you know, a pipeline or that kind of thing is probably really the only way this could work in this area. And I definitely, you know, want to see the local benefits be part of it. And obviously flood control is probably our biggest need in the Delta. And I'm glad Mr. Henderson mentioned the EJ issues in the communities where the emissions would be allowed to continue occurring, because I think that's something that we all should be concerned about and need to be taken into account. And there would need to be local benefits and environmental controls in those locations as well, so that they're not suffering as a result of these projects. So thanks for the opportunity to comment.
Thanks, Osha. Any other public comments?
There are not.
Okay, thank you, Beck. Well, in that case, thank you again to our panel members. Terrific presentation. I think that through Jeff, we at the council will be learning more about this, and so we'll continue the coordination. Thank you. So council members, on to agenda item 10, preparation for the next council meeting. Our next council meeting will again be on the third Thursday to avoid the holiday, and it'll be December 16, 2021 via Zoom. Thank you everyone for your time and attention. Good to see you all, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Have a good Thanksgiving.